Hello, my name is Thomas. Welcome to British Culture. Albion never dies. In the alphabet of Britishness, I'm looking at the letter S this month. And many friends messaged me to suggest that S could be for Simon Templar, better known as the Saint. And what better person to help me look at this classic series of British novels than British novelist Roland Hume. He last joined me to look at Lady Chatterley's Lover. He's told me about his experience as a Brit in the USA, and now he's joining me for one of his deep and abiding passions, the novels by Leslie Charteris, The Saint. So I hope you enjoy this episode.
Okay, Roland Hume, thank you very, very much for joining me.
Oh, it is an absolute pleasure. Always a pleasure speaking to you.
I wanted to talk about a British book series, and I thought, who better to talk about some classic British novels than a British novelist?
Yes, and you very kindly indulged me by talking about the one intellectual property that I am more obsessive about than James Bond.
Wow. Okay. And it's something that it's on my backbone of things I've always meant to read. And I've never been known where exactly to start, because people would ask me about Ian Fleming, which Ian Fleming book to read first. And obviously you can start chronologically with Casino Royale. I shall say now, it's not my favorite, and it's not where I tell people to start, because it's where Fleming is learning how to write Bond. Like, if you love the films and you want to read one of the books, it's not the logical place to start, I don't think.
No.
So that's why I look at these book series like The Saint, and I'm very curious where to start. Like, what is the most The Saint book out of The Saint book series?
You know, that's so interesting. I think it was the one I first read. So growing up, my family was obsessed with books, and my mother is a writer, a published writer. She wrote nonfiction, and my father is obsessed with books. So we had like 3,000 books growing up, and I was just getting into James Bond. I liked these things, and my father said, "You should read The Saint." And I was like, "What's The Saint?" And so he gave me for my 18th birthday this book, which is The Saint in New York. And I was like, what's this about? Because I was vaguely aware there was a TV show with Roger Moore, and it was kind of like a James Bondy thing. And this book is the perfect book to start, The Saint in New York. And it's about this chap called Simon Templar, better known as The Saint, who travels to New York to sort of clean up the crime. And it's the perfect entry into the book. I think it might have been like the 10th book in the series or something like that. But it introduces in such a wonderful way to this character of Simon Templar, who's the saint, who is, I would actually say you physically fit the description of the saint. He's around 6'2" or something like that, slim build, always immaculately dressed, jet black hair, bright blue eyes, a piratical smile. And he's the Robin Hood of modern crime. So what he does is he has these wild adventures where he finds somebody who's a bit naughty. He calls them the ungodly. So like blackmailers and thieves and murderers and things. And he will go and give them their comeuppance. And the original stories, they were written by this chap called Leslie Charteris. And they would normally follow the formula of the saint would meet this chap who was up to no good, a naughty person, and then come up with some interesting way for him to basically engineer his own comeuppance. You know, maybe there was one story where he was trying to sell some fraudulent blueprints to a fake helicopter. And this is written in the 30s when helicopters were like all new and exciting. And the twist was that the saint fools him into thinking that actually, if you put together these parts of the helicopter the correct way, it would actually work. So he ends up buying it back for a huge exorbitant fee, and then he realizes that he's been conned. So they're very satisfying stories, because long or short, they always end up having this really delightful, satisfying twist in the end.
Ah, and he doesn't kill, right? There's no license to kill. He doesn't cross that line.
Absolutely. Actually, he does. Yes. So he's a precursor to James Bond, but he's almost like James Bond on steroids. So you never quite understand his backstory, but he quite happily, if there's a chap he doesn't like who, you know, was up to no good, like somebody who killed somebody but got away with it or something, then he will absolutely straight up murder him. Yes, and he always gets away with it. This is part of the thing. He has a cat and mouse game with the police. There's a one particular police officer called Chief Inspector Claude Eustace Teal, who's always been trying to pin something on the saint. And every time the saint manages to wiggle out of it by coming up with some alibi or some excuse. And the early books, are much more sort of novel based, and there are some where, you know, he goes on the run and eventually he gets a sort of a pardon at the end, but he can be quite tense. But he breaks the law. He's an absolute unrepentant lawbreaker, and he's kind of a cad, but at the same time he's wonderfully hyperbolic and charming. In the 30s, I guess there wasn't quite the James Bond hadn't been invented, so the Saint was this unique and vibrant character that people hadn't seen in the public consciousness. And they made a bunch of movies and about him in the 30s, and then they made that wonderful series about him, but people hadn't seen a hero like this. And James Bond, I think, was definitely born from this. James Bond is a sort of more grounded version of the Saint, right down to in the Saint books he would throw his hat across the room and it would land on the hat rack, and they like literally stole that for the James Bond movies.
I was wondering from your description how much you think that relationship, you know, was. It sounds like it was Fleming took liberally.
Absolutely. And I mean, the Saint was always immaculately dressed. And I think they even went down to some, you know, he'd have Savile Row suits. And I think there was one time they even mentioned he had like Turnbull and Asser trousers or something like that. But it was the immaculately dressed, always handsome. The women would throw themselves at him. He always had tons of money. He drove this beautiful big car called the Hirondelle. These days, I think with our modern cynical impression, if you would like read it unironically, then it would be a bit over the top. And you'd be like, oh yeah, sure, right. We like our heroes to be a bit wounded and grounded and stuff like that. But back in the, when it was originally written, they were just like so vibrant and different. And then you read them now and they are really, really enjoyable. Even now, they're written in a very poetic style. I think maybe the writing style is a little archaic, but once you get into the flow of it, they're beautiful. And they're really satisfying stories.
I'm thinking for archaic style. I absolutely love Rudyard Kipling. There is an archaic style. I read Fleming. This sounds like a good midpoint between the adventures of Kipling and the adventures of Ian Fleming.
Absolutely. He's a very clever writer as well. So you read them and you enjoy like the wordplay and stuff like that. Leslie Charteris is the chap who invented them. He's quite interesting because he was half Chinese and half British. And I think that it was quite a challenge for him to sort of go and live in Britain and be half Chinese and half British. And he was sort of from a good background. And I think he never quite felt like he fit into British society, which is kind of one of the things about the Saint, is like he has that outsider's perspective. And I think just like James Bond, the outsider's perspective, that's why he appeals to me and might appeal to you. The Saint was always an outsider, and he was always like looking at the world from the outside in and highlighting some of the hypocrisies and some of the bad parts of society. And some of the stories would be him actually getting the comeuppance with getting that person to have their comeuppance. There was one story about him having a tax bill and how he then decided he didn't want to pay this tax bill, so he found some nefarious character who was up to no good and specifically stole the amount of money from him to pay his tax bill. And these just wonderfully subversive things. But anyway, it must have been so unique back in the 30s when they were written.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering if, you know, that background of being half British makes his writing somehow more British than the British. Is there an element to that?
I think there is as well. And it was, there's one interview with Leslie Charteris that I've seen. He went on the Hindenburg, that's it. And after he landed in New York flying on the Hindenburg, he gave this speech about how wonderful it was. And he had an upper crust British accent, and he always wore beautiful clothes and things. But there was always that outsider's perspective. And I think he ended up moving to America, where he had to register every year during World War II because he was East Asian. So, you know, all the Japanese were put in internment camps. So even in America, a place which adopted him, he still was that outsider. He was still never fully like accepted. But I think that was part of the reason why Simon Templar as a character is just such a unique and interesting character and appeals to people like us who kind of don't quite fit in with the normal society.
And you mentioned before Roger Moore, because that's the version of the Saint I've seen a few episodes of. How close is that to the books?
I think the two are almost, you can't peel them apart. I mean, in some ways you'd think the Saint would, you know, he had black hair and he would be taller and maybe a bit more swell. But I think Roger Moore is as much the Saint as you could possibly get. And the funny thing is watching, especially like Live and Let Die, he's almost Simon Templar. It's almost like Roger Moore as Simon Templar as James Bond, because the way he plays it in the TV show and the way he plays it in the movie are identical.
I watched it, one of my favorite Bond films is The Man with the Golden Gun. And when I watched The Saint, I was like, this is all the bits of his performance that I like.
Yes. That's one of my favorite Bond films as well. And it's exactly that.
One of the things I really like about The Man with the Golden Gun is that Bond kills one person, the villain, the person he's actually sent to kill. He doesn't kind of blaze through vast numbers of henchmen or anything like that. And it makes you wonder about rules of engagement and war crimes and so on. I mean, he does do his job. The villain is the one killing people. Bond is the one stopping him, which is why I wondered about the Saint, the rules of engagement for the Saint.
Yeah, and I think that would the Saint likes to play cat and mouse games, and you could almost the Man of the Golden Gun is a movie. That's almost the exact thing. He plays cat and mouse, and then they have these the dinner table when he's sitting there chatting to Scaramanga, and you know Scaramanga admires him, and he has these wonderful lines, the byplay and the back and forth. That's very Saint like.
Mm. So I'm also curious, again, just to make a direct comparison to Fleming. Fleming obviously did 007 in New York. And you have recommended to me The Saint in New York. I think 007 in New York is one of those novels they haven't adapted or stories they haven't adapted because Fleming wasn't so keen on New York at the time. And it makes for melancholy reading. It seems like The Saint liked this location.
Yes, I think so. The Saint in New York is almost like a love letter to New York. And it was written in 1930, I think. He stays in the Waldorf Astoria, for example, which still exists now on Park Avenue. And I think the Empire State Building had just been built. So it's almost like a love letter to New York. And I think Charteris loved America because he spent a long time there. Mm. And they're completely separate because the Saint in New York is a wonderful full-length novel with rich characters and a twist in the end and wonderful action and adventure scenes and stuff. Whereas 007 in New York is like, almost feels like filler.
Yeah.
Wonderful scrambled eggs recipe though.
Yeah. Which had to be included in an apology because he insulted New York so heavily.
Actually, I shouldn't even call it a scrambled eggs recipe. It's more a butter recipe that includes eggs.
Oh yes. I have tried it and I just can't try it again. Like I'm not demonstrating for the podcast or the video just because it's so rich. And he uses Jersey butter, which is even richer. I'm like,
And funny, he died of a heart attack at a young age. It's almost as if the two are related.
We will never know.
But I would definitely recommend, if you are going to start reading The Saint and you want to read a full-length Saint story, The Saint in New York is the perfect one. This, I think, if you wanted to get a good gauge of who Simon Templar was and what The Saint was, and you could only read one book, this is it. Which... Yeah. I have like one of the world's biggest collections of Saint stories, which I didn't mean to do at all. But wow. The first book he ever wrote was this one called The Saint Meets the Tiger. And the author actually, he took it off sale because he didn't like it. He wrote it and it's an okay book. But then he said it didn't quite fit what he wanted to do. So he kind of like rebooted the character after the first book. And he did eventually re-release it, and that's where I got this copy from. But
do you find it reads differently from the others?
Yeah, it's more of a traditional story in which the character's kind of finding his feet, and then by the time you read the second and the subsequent books, it's like there's no introduction to the Saint. The Saint is just there. He's just this wonderful, tall, handsome man who has this. You don't really learn anything of his background. He's just there and reacts to the things that go on about him, which is kind of nice because every single book, and they wrote a ridiculous number of books. I think there were like 80 in the end. Okay. And it spanned from 1928 was the first one. And I think the final one was written in like 1986. But The Saint at all times is, you know, in his 30s, in his prime. Okay. But the wonderful thing about the way he writes them is that actually works because you almost don't have any callback to the previous books, especially later on in the series.
Does he move time frame? Are there stories set in the 70s and 60s and 80s? Or is
they're
it always
all contemporary?
Okay.
Which is interesting, absolutely to your point. So the bulk of them were written in sort of the 30s. Mm. And then during the war, there are a couple that released. And then sort of the 50s and 60s, there are a bulk more. But they were all written as contemporary books. And he even in the 60s, he even had to say, you know, this when they reprinted them, like this book was written in the 30s. So certain things were different. Like you still had horse and carriage in London and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. So the stories can kind of update, a bit like the James Bond character in the movies. You know, he's always the same age pretty well. It's just the gadgets update.
I always say Tintin is a good equivalent to it because, you know, spanned. Though the last Tintin book was written in the 70s and he wore jeans and bell bottoms and stuff. Mm. But it's like he's still this young 20-something reporter and it's the same for The Saint all the way through.
Oh, okay. Oh, that is interesting. And I didn't realize there's such a vast number of Saint books.
Yeah, it's so when they first started off, my favorite Saint novel is this one, which was written in 1930, called The Saint Closes the Case. And it was written in 1930. The impact of the World War I was very much fresh on people's minds, and also fascism was rising in Germany. And so he wrote a book about somebody who invents a doomsday machine, or this terrible machine that can kill people. It was a death cloud, because it was the 30s and science fiction was kind of that thing. So the saint decides he's going to kill the chap who invented this weapon, and so it would never meet the battlefield. And that's what happens, which, when you think about it, that's almost like a villain's plot, isn't it? But he finds this person, and he takes him off, and he tries to convince him not to release this weapon. And the man is a madman, and he's like, "I must. This is my gift to the world." And there's this nasty chap from some unspecified Eastern European country who wants to get the death ray for himself. And the saint ends up killing this chap in cold blood, so his weapon will never be released. And then the next four books are him going on the chase. And but it's interesting, because that's the book was written at, like, so typical of its time. And it was really, really vivid, and it had a rich cast of characters. But as the books went on and it became more popular, they certainly became more like products. So the first few books, he actually had a team of friends, like this chap Hoppy Nates, and there was a chap called Norman Kent, and his girlfriend Patricia Home. But as the books went on, it became just the Saint. And it almost started to adopt the format of the 60s TV show, where the saint would arrive somewhere, have an adventure, and then disappear off. But the saint would be the only reoccurring character. And the books became shorter. And eventually he started farming out the writing of the books. In fact, there was one published in 1978 called Send for the Saint. And this is the new edition, which I'm very proud of, because it has a foreword by me.
Oh, wow.
I know I'm that much of a Saint fan, but towards the end they became product to a certain extent, and kind of cookie cutter products. So the later ones aren't nearly as enjoyable as the beginning ones, but they're always enjoyable. It's almost like watching an episode of the A-Team or Star Trek or something. It's like, you sit down and you're going to have 40 minutes of good fun.
Yeah, I mean, I remember in the A-Team is the second series, I think, where Face. They are to talk about shall we make a plan, and Face is like, oh, I'll probably just go along there, have a fight, lose, then we'll regroup and come up with a second plan, and then we'll go along and win. And I
Yeah.
was like, okay.
And I mean, I formulas work, to be honest. I write romance novels, and I find the thing about sticking to a formula is it does end up with a very satisfying product. And so people complain about formula, but I almost think formulaic books are like long form poetry. You want to tell the story that you want to tell, but you want to hit all of these beats so it's satisfying for the reader to read. And then when you combine those two, it's satisfying.
Move it into my territory. It's like George Lucas says, it's like poetry, it rhymes.
Yes, actually, I remember that. Yeah, and you have the same beats coming again and again.
Yeah, Obi-Wan Kenobi walks into a bar, he cuts a hand off, his apprentice is there at Skywalker. Happens twice, once with Anakin, once with Luke,
Yep.
and their different reactions speak so much, the different characters. It highlights how different they are. He's a great writer. I've got to say, someone's got to say it.
My middle child, he's just got into Star Trek, Star Wars, in a big way, and we're watching the prequels, and like, I really enjoy them. I enjoy the prequels, and I enjoy the writing, and I enjoy the storytelling, and what he's trying to build. I mean, you think a movie series aimed at young kids, there's an awful lot of like trade disputes and Senate representations in the prequels, which work, because you've got lightsaber battles in between them.
It's yeah, I'm obviously blown away by it. I have my collection of books right here.
And then the wonderful thing about books at the moment, yeah, my 11-year-old, he's reading. They did publish this series of books when the prequels are released about Boba Fett as an 11-year-old, and like, he's devouring these books and reading them, and it's so fun because it gets you into stories and it gets you into characters. And so I think finding a character who really resonates with you can open up the world of books and storytelling. And for me, that was the Saint. I mean, I loved the Saint, absolutely. And at the end of every Saint book, they would have this little thing of the Saint symbol, and it says, "Just join up to the Saint Club." And I had these books published in the that were published in the 40s or 50s. And one day, when I was a teenager, I actually wrote a letter to the Saint Club, and I got a response. And it turned out there was a chap who lived in Romsey, which is just down the road from me when I was living in Hampshire, who is now the president of the Saint Club. And we got chatting, and he ended up reading the first ever book I ever wrote, which is called Adventure Eddie. And he actually read it and he said, it's pretty good. Then you could do this better and you could do that better. And as a result of that, I was encouraged to write the next one. And then I wrote another one, another one. So in some ways, I would never have become a writer if it wasn't for The Saint. And if it wasn't that chap, he's called Ian Dickerson and he's a wonderful chap. And he recently gave me, they were cleaning out the Leslie Charteris is passed away a few years ago and his wife passed away even more recently. They were clearing out his stuff and I got a big delivery of boxes of books that used to belong to Leslie Charteris and like have his signature in and stuff like that. So
gosh.
I'm and completely these, obsessed.
Yeah. Are these books that Charteris has written or Charles that he collected?
That he collected. These are books gifted to him that he had in his collection. So, yeah.
These are the books that may have influenced him, just as his books influence you.
I know. And it's funny. One of the things I enjoy, you were just doing a lot of posts about the railway children and stuff that. We think there are books that we got introduced to that influenced us so much. I mean, Ian Fleming, of course. When did you first read Ian Fleming?
I read him at university. And... yeah, I happened to join the University Royal Naval Unit around the same time. And I don't know, all these experiences came together. And obviously, I've been living in Turkish Cyprus for 7 years. So when I got to From Russia with Love, where he describes Istanbul so well, I know it's just, it grabbed me. I suppose I wanted something apart from Kipling to read.
Yeah. Although Kipling's wonderful. But I mean, I know I read the around that time is when I was started reading the Ian Fleming books. And you know, I was off to the charity shop to buy my first suit. And I would wear these charity shop suits for like the next 7 years. And everyone would be like, oh, he's always wearing a suit. He's so well dressed. And there I go, my 10-pound suit.
Exactly. I think I was, I was definitely wearing suits at university and so on.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how these books can really influence us. I'm curious, you mentioned the cast of characters. So in the novels, the Saint has a change of cast with each book. In the
original ones, it was wonderful because you had an ensemble cast. So we had there was the Saint Simon Templar, and he had an ambiguous girlfriend called Patricia Holmes. So obviously, he was madly in love with her. She was madly in love with him. Sometimes he'd go off and be with another girl, and she never seemed to mind. But you know, they were paired together, and he had a friend called Norman Kent who was madly in love with Patricia. But of course, he knew that Patricia's heart belonged to the Saint, so there was always that like little love triangle going on. And then he had other friends, Roger Conway and Peter Quentin. And when he had his adventures, they were much more of an ensemble thing. And his friends would, you know, if he in this book in particular, the Saint was like, "Oh, this chap invented a death ray. Let's go and kill him." And his friends were like, "Whose car do we take?" And and there was a wonderful scene of sacrifice in the end. But there was just this friendship and this camaraderie. And there was one line stuck with me where he talks about the best thing in life is comradeship and careless laughter. And I think that for me is what I get out of being part of like the Bond community. It was, we all got together in Newtown, Pennsylvania the other day, and it was great hanging out with people and we were laughing and there was a sense of comradeship. And I think that's one of the values that I got out of reading the books. You know, I had quite a lonely upbringing because I grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere, and it made me value and appreciate having really close friends and also appreciate, you know, believing in things. I think that's the other thing. The Saint is, he's very black and white and he believes in things and possibly they're morally ambiguous to our own standards. But I think having something you believe in and stand for, I think is an admirable quality to have. So, you know, that was one of the qualities I took from him.
Thank you very much. That's the perfect place to leave the discussion about the Saint. The book you recommended to start with is The Saint in New York. And just one more thing, which is that, you know, we've mentioned how the Saint influenced your writing. Which of your books do you think is the most influenced by the Saint? Is there one of your books that you'd say is an ode to the Saint?
It's interesting. It's I wouldn't necessarily recommend it as one of my best books, but the second full-length novel I wrote is called The Bootleg Boys. And it has my ubiquitous character called Adventure Eddie, and he gets screwed over. It's actually kind of... he gets screwed over by this chap who bootlegs stuff. So I don't know. This might be for a non-British crowd. This might be a little confusing. But in England, you used to get a big white van and then you used to take the ferry to France and load it up with cigarettes and beer and then bring it back because you would pay so much less for it in France than you would in the UK. And that's kind
the booze cruise.
The Booze Cruise, exactly. And so the my hero, Eddie Newbolt, who is nicknamed Adventure Eddie, and it's not nearly as hokey as it sounds because he's kind of a bit of a clueless chap, decided he was going to get some money from this chap by bootlegging all this stuff. And then this chap rips him off and steals it all. So he decides he's going to do the saintly thing and get his revenge and get his money back. And so the whole thing, the whole scheme of the Bootleg Boys is kind of like a heist movie. And things go wrong at the end. And there are life or death consequences. But I think I was very much inspired by The Saint because I had this, like, you know, if people do wrong, you want them to face justice. And I still, to this day, I still believe that, you know, you get nasty pieces of work who don't get their comeuppance. And you're like, one day I would like to give that person their comeuppance. And I think that's, and you get to do that in fiction, whereas you, unfortunately, you don't often get to do that in real life.
I think that's a perfect place to leave it. Thank you very much for joining me to talk about The Saint. I feel I need to go and read two books now.
Well, I would definitely recommend The Saint in New York. The Bootleg Boys is quite fun. You might enjoy it.
I'll give it a go. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed. Please do check out Roland Hume's books on Amazon. And yeah. Time for us all to start rereading The Saint.